Thank you, Earl. I am Bunny, and I am an alcoholic. It's only through the grace of God and the help of this program, people just like each one of you, that I'm here tonight and sober. I didn't know it was going to be like this. You know, I never thought in my wildest dreams that I'd be here. I really didn't. And I've never felt quite this way before. You see, I came to my first Mount Eagle Roundup about 9 years ago through Nancy and George, my sponsor and one of my dearest friends. And I was new, and I was scared, and I was sick, and I used to sit right where all of you are and listen to the speakers, and this is a very humbling experience to be here. It really is. I hope I have something to pass on to all of you because you have all given me so much. And when I think about being here in this position tonight, it always makes me go back and think about how I got here. You know, how did I get where I am today? What were the forces that came to play in my life that brought me to where I am today? I've been in a state of transition in my life recently, and I've been going through a lot of things. I've been reading a lot of things, old things that I had stored away, cleaning out a lot of things, throwing some things away, saving some things. And I've looked at an area of my life that since I've been sober, the 10.5 years I've been sober, I haven't dared to look at. My past, my childhood. Oh, I took care of those things when I initially did my fourth and fifth step that I knew I had to clean up and take care of if I was going to go on living and working this program. But there was a whole lot of stuff that I didn't look at. I believe, among the things I just plain believe, is the fact that things are revealed to us in this program as we're able to look at them and as we're able to accept them. And so it's been with me. As I become ready to look at an area of my life, as I become ready to accept what it says and does for me, God unfolds it to me. And I have to keep remembering that it's God's plan and not mine. Because you see, if I had planned my life, I wouldn't be where I am today. The things wouldn't be happening to me that are happening. I have to keep remembering that it's God's plan for me and not mine. And it's okay. In fact, the things in my life are so tremendously beautiful and meaningful that no human could have possibly planned them. And I really am convinced of that. But I've been looking at some things about my childhood, and I've never talked about that when I've told my story before. And one of the realizations I've come to in looking at that is that I wasn't so bad after all. I felt to myself that even as a little girl, that I was a bad person, that I was a evil person. And when I came to AA and started to talk to you people, I found out that I wasn't an evil person, I was a sick person. And that meant a great deal to me. And I thought it applied to my drinking years. And I hadn't gone back and looked at my childhood. I was a pretty different kind of a kid when I was growing up. I was a very moody child. I was a very lonely child. The loneliness began long before I took my first drink. And I look back now, and I think about the way I was, and then I remember when I took my first drink. And when I think about it, I was an alcoholic already for that drink. And it just took the drink to make my illness come alive. So I'm one of those people who really believe I was an alcoholic from the very first drink. Oh, I didn't drink every day, and I didn't get drunk every time I drank. But I didn't drink normally. I never drank like those normal drinkers, whatever, whoever they are, you know. I always drank for the wrong reasons, with the wrong people many times, and started to get in trouble early on with my drinking. So all of the ingredients that I feel are a part of my alcoholism were there. So I'm an alcoholic through and through. I was before I took the drink. I was during the drinking years. I am today, and I'm going to be the rest of my life. And after that, I don't know. So that's one thing I'm thoroughly aware of, and that I've made some peace with myself as a little girl recently, and with myself growing up, with some of the things I did, with some of the things I was. And I've accepted it, and it's okay, and I've realized it wasn't all bad. There were some very good things about it. I was brought up in a very religious atmosphere where drinking wasn't allowed or expected, certainly. In fact, my paternal grandfather was a Methodist minister, and I never said anything, the least bit derogatory about him, because nobody did. And he was one of five brothers, and they were all Methodist ministers. And he didn't believe in doing anything that was fun. Nothing. You know. He didn't believe in women who painted their fingernails or put lipstick on or cropped their hair the way they used to call it in those days or went to movies or dated or anything, you know. And so if you did anything like that, you just didn't tell. And coming from a background like that, it's no wonder that I was loaded with guilt. I felt guilty sometimes as a child just for being, just for the fact that I existed. So you can imagine what with the drinking and all the rest of the things and painted toenails and fingernails and all of that, you can imagine the kinds of feelings that I grew up with. But when I got into the alcoholism, some things happened to me inside. You see, all my life when I was growing up, I look back now as the kind of kid that would lay in fields and look at clouds and look at stars and dream and plan. And none of it ever came true, so I was always unhappy and dissatisfied. I was looking for something, and I kept thinking that when I went up over the next hill or went around the next corner, I was going to find it, whatever it was. And it would be revealed to me, and I'd know the secret. I'd know the answer. You know, that's the way that I felt. Well, when I started drinking, I thought I'd found it. That was the answer. That was the magic elixir that gave me the thing that I was looking for all my life, which was, as I think about it now, a feeling of being comfortable in the world. For the first time, I felt like I fit, like there was a niche for me. Because when I drank, I felt better about me. I had always felt so inadequate, like I never measured up, that I never could be what my parents, my grandfather, what the people in my life expected of me or wanted me to be. So I was always the cut-up, the one that acted up, and I got a lot of attention, but it wasn't the kind that I really wanted and really was looking for. But when I began to drink, I felt like I was all of those things that I'd wanted to be and that I was looking for. You know, I could walk up to people and talk to them. I could get up and dance. The dreams I seemed to be dreaming came true. You know, and I looked in the mirror and I wasn't that gawky person that I always thought I looked like, you know. And everything was clouded and hazed over with the drink. And I lived in a dream world for 20 years of alcoholic drinking. And the beautiful thing that the alcohol seemed to be doing for me began to take more booze to do. And I began to drink more and more to get the beautiful feeling. I think all of us, if we're really honest about it, and anybody asked us why we drink the way we drank, we'd have to answer it would be to feel good, to feel comfortable, to find our place in the world. That's the reason it was for me. And then pretty soon, you see, this whole thing backfired on me. I thought it was going to be my big secret, and I would keep it from everybody that I drank for these reasons. And then partway through, all of a sudden I was drinking and not getting the beautiful feeling. It wasn't there anymore, and I was looking for it, and it wasn't happening. And anybody with any sense probably would have taken a good look at that and said, well, I think I'll quit. The drink isn't doing it anymore. Why don't you just quit, dummy, you know? And of course I kept saying, well, I will. A little bit down, I'm just not ready yet. I can quit any time I want to. Early in my drinking, I began to have physical symptoms. I had high blood pressure, the hypertension, and I got treated for that. I hyperventilated a lot, where they had to often take me to the doctor or to the hospital, and, you know, you felt like you were just going to die. And if you've ever had that, it's sometimes they tell you to breathe in a paper bag. Does that ring a bell with anybody? And I had that quite a bit. And I had all kinds of kidney problems, bladder disorders. I had strange pains that moved around my body, and I kept ending up in the hospital and in and out of the hospital. I had a lot of physical problems due to my drinking, and I think that was probably one of the first symptoms that was recognizable. The mental part, of course, had started long before I took the first drink, too, you see, because I was all mixed up mentally. I was looking in the wrong places for the wrong things. I was really mentally ill, I think, long before I picked up my first drink. And so that was a big problem. I can remember during the 20 years of my drinking, about in the middle, because the first 10 years, even though they weren't normal drinking, the physical symptoms were the only things that were really recognizable. And everybody covered it up. I was one of those people that was greatly protected in my drinking, you know, socked away somewhere and supplied with booze and protected. Nobody wanted anybody to know that I drank too much. My husband didn't want people to know. My kids didn't want people to know. They just stopped. I was talking with somebody this afternoon about that. They just stopped bringing their friends home, you know. They never could predict what I would be like. So I was hidden away. But I can remember about halfway through, because my daughter was just a baby, and she was 9 when I came to AA. I'd get all those kids in bed early. My husband has always traveled a lot, so I've been alone a great deal of the time, alone to drink. And I get those kids fed and in bed really early when it was still light out in the summertime. You know, I'd put those kids to bed so I could drink. And then those days I drank mostly wine, and I drank it, I bought it by the half gallon. I never bought a half pint in my life. You know, so many people talk about half pints. So easy to slip in your purse. Even better, miniatures. I have a friend who drank just miniatures, and they're so easy to slip in your purse. But I never, you know, I bought half gallons. I thought big. And you people think you had trouble hiding bottles. I always had a terrible time getting rid of the empties. The full ones weren't as much of a problem as the empties. And I would just be tortured with the idea of, here my husband was coming home on a Friday, and I had these empty half-gallon wine bottles, and I didn't know what to do with them, where to put them, you know? And so when most mothers were picking their kids up at school or going to PTA or doing some of those good things you're supposed to do, Bunny was driving around in the family station wagon with a big bag of empty half-gallon wine bottles next to me on the seat, trying to find a place to stash them, because he was coming home. And he always had a way of going through the trash and counting the empties. Oh, it used to make me so mad. That's what he'd do. So here I am driving around, and I've stood in fields, and I've thrown them in the woods, and we had a dump one place where we lived where you go and pay the man a quarter, and you could leave your trash, and I would pay the man a quarter and hand him this big bag of bottles, and I want to get out of there real fast, because I thought everybody could tell just by looking at me what I was doing and what terrible life I was living, you know. And then I thought I had found the perfect place to stash my half-gallon wine bottles, and I drove into the shopping center and put them in the big yellow Goodwill box. You know? And when I started looking back on my drinking and the insanity part of this, the mental part of the illness, I realized, you know, normal people don't do things like that. Normal people don't drive around with bags of empty bottles trying to find a place to hide them. Normal people don't sneak drinks, hide drinks, and go through that torture. My life became a total involvement between buying the booze, hiding the booze, drinking the booze, and then getting more to drink. And it was a constant total involvement. And in between, with as much as I could muster, I tried to fit in the things that I thought were necessary in my life, like taking care of the family and things like that. But that took a much lesser degree of importance in my life as my drinking progressed. I became totally involved just in the drinking and how I was going to get through all of that. So the mental part of the illness, and, you know, all the lady drunks have house coats, I have found out. I had an old house coat, and I was ashamed to tell anybody about it for a long time, but I realize now that all lady drunks have an old house coat. And mine was red and white, and it very strangely disappeared when I sobered up. I never asked what happened to it, but I used to sit in that red and white house coat. It was usually dirty, and it was old, and it was all messed and wrinkled, and I would sit in that house coat with my booze on the end of the couch. This was toward the end of my drinking, and I had an air conditioner that played heavenly music. I don't know if you had a fancy air conditioner like that, but I did. And it half fascinated me and half scared me to death. And I'd sit there shaking on the end of the couch, and the drapes would be drawn because I didn't want anybody to see in. I didn't want to see out. If the doorbell rang, I wouldn't even answer it. And if the phone rang, most of the time I wouldn't answer it. And I sat there shaking, afraid, scared to death. You know, if you'd asked me what I was afraid of, I couldn't have told you what I was afraid of. I was just frightened. It was like the enemy was out there lurking somewhere, and he was invisible. I couldn't see him. But I was afraid. Something was going to get me, you know. Something horrible was going to happen to me. And I couldn't explain it. I couldn't put my finger on it. I tried all the usual avenues of help. I was certainly in the hospital quite a bit. And so doctors, you know, would dry me out and send me home, and like any good alcoholic, I'd either buy a bottle on the way home or the next day. You know, they'd throw up their hands and they'd say, gee, we just can't help Bunny. We don't know what's wrong with her because she just doesn't stay well. Then I went to the psychiatrist, and I'm not knocking them. I think we need them. But they never helped me because they always approached it this way. They said, well, look, we'll talk about your problems and get your problems ironed out, and then you won't have to drink so much. Not one ever said to me, just quit drinking. Not one. You know? And I went to marriage counselors because your marriage always gets in trouble. And I went to ministers because I kind of had the feeling inside that I was becoming very alienated from one of the centers of my being, and that was a belief of some kind. And I most certainly was. But they couldn't help me. How can you get in touch with anything meaningful in your life when you're drunk? Drinking or drunk? My husband used to say you keep a constant stream of alcohol going through your body all the time. You know, you might become an alcoholic someday. You know, and I was from the very first. I already was an alcoholic. So those are the kinds of things that we were going through. And I look back on that and I think, well, that's total insanity. You know, one of the things that I feel very, very deeply about is the family aspect of this illness. And I never believed that in the beginning because I always said I wasn't hurting anybody but myself. And I realize more and more constantly on a day-to-day basis how much I've hurt the people that I love, the people in my life who are dear to me, who loved me and tried to help me. Part of going back through things was revisiting my parents who died during the last year and a half of my drinking and trying to make peace with them, which I have really done, but which I had not done completely. Looking back on my childhood, you know, I had a tendency to want to blame them. It was their fault. They never prepared me for life. They never prepared me for the things that were to come. They never taught me how to drink, certainly. You know, they just didn't drink until later on in life. And I wanted to find a thread of the genetic part of it, maybe, you know, so that I could say, well, look, they passed it on to me in the genes. Neither one of them were alcoholic, however, but I do have it in my background. And I thought, I wanted to find somebody to blame it on. I wanted to blame it on my husband because he was gone all the time, because I had to be both mother and father and make a lot of decisions and so forth. I wanted to blame it on the kids because they were always there and bothering me and pestering me. I wanted to blame it on the fact, and here's the best one, that we moved 11 times in the 20 years of my drinking. Isn't that a good reason to drink? No, that's the best one I could think of. Gosh, if you had to move around the country like that and make new friends and get settled in different places, wouldn't you drink? You'd have to do something, wouldn't you? You know, so I tried to find something to blame it on. I tried to find something that I could put it on. And I was so relieved to find out when I came to this program, there isn't any blame. It's not my fault. It's not my husband's fault, my children's fault, my parents' fault. It's an illness that's affected all of us that we all need to recover from. I always tell a story about my oldest son when I talk, and I tell it because I need to remember it. And it happened later on in my drinking. I didn't realize how deeply affected they were. My husband had left me, and he had left before, but he always came back because he said he had no place to go. And this time, he took all of his things, packed all his clothes and shoes, and he has a thing about shoes. He keeps them in a row, you know, with shoe trees in them all. And when I looked in the closet and saw them gone, I knew he was serious about it. And he packed all this stuff in the car, and he drove off. Well, you know, I sometimes ask people, how do you think I felt? Upset? Hurt? I was relieved. Good riddance. He was always standing in the way of my drinking all I wanted to drink. And now he was gone, and I was free to drink. You remember that feeling? You know, you always have somebody there pouring out the booze or saying, don't drink so much, or you need to do something about your drinking. You get mad, don't you? I always resented that. Well, when he drove off, I was so relieved. I remember taking the bottles down out of the cupboard, staying them big as life on the kitchen counter. I was really going to drink all I wanted to drink. And here's part of what doesn't get revealed to you till later, because I didn't find this out till later. As my husband drove down the street, we were living in Houston, Texas at the time, my two boys, who were 12 and 15, were at the corner at a 7-Eleven store. My oldest son was sitting on the curb. And as my husband drove by, Dave said, "Dad, where are you going?" And he said, "Well, Mom's drinking again, and I'm not going to stay home and put up with it. I've just had all I can take, and I'm going for good this time." And he drove off. And my son, Dave, came running home, and he found me in the kitchen pouring a drink. And I remember it so well because he walked in the kitchen, and he had tears in his eyes, and he said, "Mom, please don't drink anymore. Everything's a mess. You don't know where we kids are. And Dad's gone." And he said, "Everything's falling apart. Mom, please don't drink anymore." And I always had an answer for them when they said that. My pat answer was, "I'm only going to have one more drink. Just one." You know, I used to get up during the night, and my husband would say, "Are you going to go drink?" Because that was my habit, to get up and drink during the night. And I'd always say, "I'm only going to have one. Just one." So I said that, and my son grabbed those bottles that were on the counter. There must have been three or four. He grabbed the bottles and he ran to the back door, and he ran out the back door with those bottles. And I went to the door and I watched him. He ran to the back of the lot. We had a detached garage, and he stood there, and by this time he was sobbing, and the tears were rolling down his face. And he threw those bottles in the tall weeds behind the garage just as hard as he could. I stood there and I watched him. I think back on that now, and I think anyone who was well and whole and sane would have been concerned about what was going on. I wasn't the least bit concerned about him. You know what I was concerned about? Sure you do. The booze. There goes my booze. And I had to have a drink. And I stood there watching this little thing take place, and I said to myself, I know I've got a bottle hidden somewhere. I know I do. It's got to be somewhere. And I went and I found it. And I staggered back to my room where I did most of my drinking. And I locked the door and I continued to drink. And you know, when I thought back on that, that did it for me. I knew that I had to be restored to sanity, because that's insane. You know, one of the biggest things in my life was falling in love and getting married. The other three were having my three children. I didn't want to be a bad wife and mother. I didn't plan my life that way. That wasn't in my plan for me at all. In fact, I believed in a fairy tale existence, you know, when I used to lay and look at those clouds and dream. I was going to be a handsome man on a white charger, and I was going to be the perfect wife and happily ever after. You know, that's how immature I was. And it wasn't working out that way at all. You know, here I was in my bedroom with the door locked, drunk. You know, it wasn't the way I wanted it to be. I really didn't want to be that kind of a person, but I was. That's what alcoholism, the illness, had done to Bunny. And you know, there's a PS to that story, and here again, this didn't get revealed to me till much later. My children were deeply upset and hurt by the alcoholism in our family. We all needed help to recover from the illness. And I think this oldest son probably was most deeply affected of any of them. And he was in college at UT Knoxville, and I'd been in the program 5 or 6 years. When he was home for Christmas one year, and we'd become friends, and he was taking his mother to the movies. And on the way to the movies, he said, "Mom, do you mind talking about those days when your drinking was so bad?" And every time they say that, I get this funny feeling here, what's coming now, you know? Something I don't want to hear. And I said, "Why, Dave?" And he said, "Well, do you remember the time that Dad left and I came running home and took those bottles and threw them away? It had never been mentioned in all those years." And I said, "Yes, I do remember that." And he said, "Well, Mom," he said, "I've come to the conclusion that it's not just the alcoholic that reaches a bottom. I think kids do, too." He said, my life was over. I simply didn't want to go on living. And he was 15 years old. Now, that's the kind of thing I don't know if I could have dealt with early in the game, that was revealed to me at a later time, that I found out. You know, talk about hurting people in your life. I can remember waking up one morning, I'm only laughing because sometimes you have to laugh. I woke up one morning and there's a big hole in the wall, in the bedroom wall. We were living in Florida at the time. You know, I told you we moved 11 times. And when we were living in Florida, I woke up and there was this big gaping hole in the bedroom wall. And at those times, I didn't ask questions. I had a lot of blackouts. I didn't ask questions. So we walked around all day with a big hole in the wall and nobody said anything about it, you know? And by late that afternoon, my husband said, "Aren't you wondering what the hole is in the wall?" And I said, "Yeah, I was kind of wondering about that." And he said, "Well, I got so mad at you last night that I put my fist through the wall." That was meant for me. You know, that's the kind of thing. Then when we moved to Houston, where I spent the last year of my drinking, we joined a country club, and my husband used to play a lot of golf. And he said he would go to the golf club and hit those golf balls so hard, and everyone had my name on it. You know, those are the kinds of things that you find out later. And let me tell you another thing I found out later that really surprised me. And I have a great feeling for you people who live with this illness of alcoholism, because I can see now how deeply affected everybody is. When I'd been in this program, I guess about 3 months, my husband said one day, "Sit down for a minute, I want to talk to you." And I sat down, he said, "Do you remember the morning you woke up and you had burns on your legs?" This is something that, had never been mentioned. And I had seen this one morning, you know, and oh, they were sore and they hurt, and I just put slacks on or something and went about my business and didn't ask questions. And this was quite a bit later than that, after I'd been sober for about 3 months, and I said, "Yes." I said, "Why?" And he said, "Well, I want to apologize to you." He said, "I'll tell you how that happened." He said, "I've always felt so guilty about it." He said, "You got up out of bed and came down the hall," and he used to say I bounced off the walls, because I was always black and blue. I would bounce from one wall to the other as I went down the hallway to the kitchen to get another drink. And he said, "You came around the corner into the den one too many times and passed out right on the floor." I had a way of just going zoom wherever I was and passing out. And someone else would have to take care of me. He said, "Instead of picking you up and carrying you back and putting you in bed, I dragged you the length of the hall. And those were rug burns on your legs." And that had been bothering him all that time. And here he'd lived through 17 years of alcoholism with me. So that just an illustration of some of the manifestations of this illness in my life. I can remember one time when I woke up in the morning and got everybody off to school and everything, and I was alone in the house, and all of a sudden, I tried to say something for some reason, and I couldn't talk. The words came out, but they were all jumbled up, and I thought, "Is that me?" It was almost like a stranger over here was talking, and I thought, what's going on? And the next thing I knew, this blood pressure, I could feel my blood pressure going up, and I looked in the mirror, my pupils were unequally dilated, and this happened over the span of a day. My left side started to get numb, and I got a neighbor, and the neighbor came over, and we called the doctor, and they rushed me to the hospital, and they diagnosed it. By that time, I was paralyzed on my left side as either an aneurysm or a brain tumor, and they told my husband that they were going to do an arteriogram and a pneumoencephalogram, and they did all of these tests. Many of them I'd had done before, like the lumbar punctures and the upper lower GIs and the skull films and all of that stuff that I'd been through before. And they were going to try to determine what the problem was and where it was. But there was one thing about that hospital experience that I never knew till much later. Here again, one time when I had been talking in Knoxville, my husband went along with me. And by the time I was through talking, everybody came up to him, and they were calling him St. Paul. His name is Paul. And I can remember on the way home, he said, "There's something that I have never told you." He said, "You happened to mention the time you were taken to the hospital and you were paralyzed on your left side." And he said, "Something I never told you about that night was that the doctor had told me there was a good chance you'd never leave the hospital, that he thought it was so serious that he didn't even know if they could do anything for you." He said, "That night, I took the three kids in our king-size bed, and we huddled there together, and we prayed that Mommy would please come home." And that's something I didn't know till much later. And that's something that I don't know whether I could have coped with until the time that it came to me. So, you know, those are some of the things that happened. I can remember another time when I was taken to a clinic in Houston, and I always had these funny spells, and some of you will be very familiar with what I'm about to say. I would shake a lot. And, you know, I'd shake a lot, I'd see and hear things that weren't there, and these funny spells, and I had no idea then what they would always eventually end me up in the hospital, or in a clinic, or in an emergency room somewhere. In fact, I can remember once when we lived in Florida, I thought about this recently, when my husband took me to the emergency room of the hospital, and I was shaking so hard, they put me out in the hall in one of these metal carts, and the metal cart was banging around on the floor in the hall, and they had me outside the emergency room, and I was very indignant because they didn't take me in there and do something for me, and doing something meant some nice shots, you know, and you just sail right off. I love to go to the emergency room, you know? But here I was, laying outside the emergency room, and they weren't taking me in, and I found they were taking all these other people in besides me, and I kept thinking, you know, this is how we are, the big I, that I was more important than anybody else, and they really ought to be treating me because I thought I was dying. You know, I half wished I would and was afraid I might. And I found out later that a family had been in a serious accident, and they were all bloody, and they were wheeling them into the emergency room. And there I was on that clinking cart, laying there, wondering why they weren't going to take me in. I just thought about that recently. It just shows you some more of the manifestations of this illness. But this time when I went to this clinic, they did all the tests, and they did some they'd done before, some EEGs and electroencephalograms. Only this time they did some sleeping EEGs. And on the sleeping EEGs, they found definite evidence of brain damage. You know, that's something I never was going to tell anybody. Because I thought, if I ever tell people that, they'll think I'm some kind of an idiot and that I can't think straight or talk straight or anything else. And certainly that, you know, that's something I'll always keep to myself. But I realize now that anybody who drank the way I did was certain to have brain damage. And it showed up on this. And then, oh, the nice part about that was they gave me lots of medication. They gave me an anticonvulsive medication because they said I had a convulsive disorder. And they found the brain damage and they gave me tranquilizers and they sent me home. And I continued to drink and take these tranquilizers. You know, that takes me up pretty close to the end of my drinking. And as I was saying, I have been going through some things that reminded me a great deal of my parents. The last time I saw my father alive was one time when we were on vacation together in the year 67, the fall of 67, and my father had tried to help me. And he took me aside the day before we were due to leave, mainly because I had been stumbling all over the place, drunk and making a fool out of myself and drinking in the morning, trying not to get caught and all of that. He knew what was going on. My dad and I had always been very good friends. He was one of my dearest friends. But as I drank and it got worse, I became alienated from everyone in my life. I didn't have any friends when I sobered up. You know, I didn't have anybody close enough to me that I would allow to see me or get in. And my father was included in that. And he took me aside on the path, I can remember, and he said, "Bunny, you need help. You know you can't drink." Oh, have you ever had anybody say that to you? I got so mad. I stood there and the anger started right up here and went right down to my toes, and I looked at him and I was shaking. I was so mad, and I said, "Dad, I'm a big girl now, and I'll take care of my own drinking." And I was never to see my father alive again. He died right there in the vacation spot. And my mother, shortly after that, came to be with us for a while. We were living in Florida at the time, and she had just lost the person closest to her. And she needed me, and I wasn't there. I was too busy in that round of things that I had told you about, buying booze, hiding booze, sneaking booze, drinking booze, you know, to really be of much help to her. And I can remember when she was with us, we went to the beach a lot, and I always took a thermos with me. Guess what was in the thermos? And I would lay on the beach, and I would say I went to sleep. What I really did was lay on the beach and pass out. And I remember waking up and looking down the beach and seeing my mother walking along. She was picking up little matching seashells to make bracelets for the grandchildren. That's about all I remember about her visit. And she left to go back home, and my sister called me a few days later and said that Mom had taken sick, and they were taking her to the hospital. And a couple weeks later, my sister called again and said, "Mom's worse, can you come?" And I was drinking when she called. I drank before I went. I drank my limit on the plane. I ended up in O'Hare Airport, and I remember I had new shoes on, and I couldn't find my sister. I was drunk when I got off the plane, and I wandered around looking for her, and I started to cry, and she finally found me sitting in the big machinery somewhere, crying, and my feet were bleeding. And that's how I arrived when my mother was so sick. I spent the last 5 days of her life with her there in the hospital, and I wasn't sober for one moment. And the day she died, I was full of vodka, and I sat there and I held her hand. You know, I'll tell you about something I came across recently that it's a very personal thing, but I feel like I want to share it with you. A little note my mother had written me when I was a little girl, I guess about 5. And in the note she said, "Bunny, as I tucked you in tonight, you asked me whether I loved you or God more." And she said, "You make me wonder. You're so much of a little philosopher." And she said, "Just before we said goodnight, you said that when I died, you wanted to go with me." I found myself about 13 months after my mother passed away in a situation where I wanted to die myself. I found myself, after all of these years of alcoholic drinking, after all the hurt, after all the hospitals, after all the trying to be the kind of person I wanted to be, trying to do better, I found myself one night at the jumping off place that the big book talks about, where you can't drink and you can't not drink. And I was sitting in my bedroom on the edge of the bed, and I had been planning this for some time. I thought, if it ever gets too bad, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to take my life. And it had gotten to the point where it was beyond anything I could endure any longer. I think the hardest thing to explain, but it's a point of identification with all of us here, is the deep loneliness associated with this illness. I was so lonely. I could have my family around me. I could be in a room with this many people in it. Or I could be all alone in my bedroom and I'd be lonely. Just lonely. And I sat there on the edge of my bed and I thought, I can't stand this loneliness one more minute. I've tried everything to solve this big problem. I don't know where to turn and I don't know what to do. And I had a twofold plan. I was going to get good and drunk and then I was going to take a bunch of pills that I'd been saving. When my mother died, I reached behind her bed and I took some pills off the back of her bed, and they were Seconal. And I'd been saving my Valium and my Librium and my Seconal and my Triavil and Meberol. Those are the things, I still remember the names of them, that I had all mixed together, and I was going to take the whole bunch, get good and drunk and take the whole bunch, and then I just would be out of this world forever. And the thought of non-existence was much more attractive to me than the thought of going on living. And I sat there on the edge of my bed, and I'd accomplished the first part of my plan. I'd gotten good and drunk. And I had this vial of pills in my hand, and I was weaving back and forth, trying to get the courage to take those pills. And all of a sudden, like a voice out of the blue, my sister's voice came to me. If I had any friend left in the world when I sobered up, it has to be one sister who stuck it out with me through thick and thin. She was the only person at the end that I could call, and she wouldn't hang up on me or tell me not to call back. The only person. She always listened. I've always wondered about that. And I've come to the conclusion that she loved me very much. She would have had to. And I remember calling her. I had telephonitis pretty badly. And it was always in the middle of the night, you know, and usually long distance. And boy, that would make my husband mad when he got those bills. But I called my sister one night, and instead of just listening to me like she usually did, and I was a crying drunk, I always cried when I was drunk, and I cried for a long time after I sobered up, too. But I called her, and I wanted her to listen to my long, sad story again, and she all of a sudden said something. She said, "Bunny, why don't you try AA? I hear they do wonderful things for people." I was insulted. AA? You know, that's for alcoholics. That's for drunks. It's not for nice people like me, you know. I almost hung up on her. Can you imagine? But I didn't, you know. We talked for a while, and I hung up the phone, and I don't know how long before this night that was. But as I sat on my bed, her voice just came out of the blue. It was as if she was in the room with me, and she said, "Bunny, why don't you try AA? I hear they do wonderful things for people." And I thought, why not? Drunk, you know. I've tried everything else, and nothing's worked. Might as well give that a shot, you know? I know now that I really didn't want to die, that I'd made the decision that as miserable as it was, I wanted to give it one last chance. I wanted to try something. And you know, I didn't know what AA was. I didn't know what it was going to be like or where it was or who it was or what it was. But I picked up the telephone book and I looked up Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was in big, bold letters in Houston. If any of you are from Houston, I've been, always been so grateful for that. And I found the number like this, and I was weaving back and forth, and I picked up that phone, middle of the night, and I dialed Alcoholics Anonymous. An answering service, and this lady says, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, started to cry, and I said, is there anybody there who can please help me? And she said, lady, how old are you? And I said, I'm 38. And she says, well, for heaven's sakes, stop crying and act your age and repeat that. And I got mad. I thought, if that's the way those AAs are going to be, who needs them? You know, I really got put out at her. And I came so close to hanging up the phone. So close. But I didn't. I repeated it. I said, is there anybody there who can please, please help me? And she said, just a minute. And the next thing I knew, there was a lady named Jeannie on the telephone. I'll never forget Jeannie. I have to smile when I say her name because Jeannie was very special and important to me. Jeannie was my link to life. I never met Jeannie. I never saw her. She was a voice in the night, but here's a human being who takes 45 minutes in the middle of the night to talk to an old crying drunk on the telephone. Amazing! I've never known of anything like that before. And I cried, and I sobbed, and I told her what I was about to do, and she didn't hang up on me. She didn't criticize me. She said, I understand. I've been there. I know how you're feeling. I've almost done what you're about to do. I said, you have? You know, I was so drunk I don't remember a whole lot of the things she said, but I remember that she was there and there was warmth and understanding in her voice. And she told me she understood. And I couldn't believe that in this whole wide world, somewhere, someplace, there was somebody that really understood how I was feeling. And we talked, and she told me that she used to drink like I did, and she had found a way of life where she doesn't have to drink anymore, and she told me about the program, and, you know, I just remember bits and pieces of it that come back to me. And then she said, would you like me to come and see you? And I took a quick look around the room, and I said, well, not tonight. And she said, well, don't drink anymore, and go to sleep, and I'll be there in the morning. And I was getting brave by that point. You know, I had really reached out and done something, and I laughed this cackling laugh on the phone, and I said, you don't think I'm really this good booze sitting here, do you? And she said, of course not. She even understood that. Can you believe it? She said, finish what's there. Go to sleep, and I'll be there in the morning. I finished what was there, and I passed out. I woke up the next morning, and I sat up in bed, and my head was going about like this, and I remembered what I had done. I called AA last night. Me. I called out. Not only that, someone's coming to see me today. I got out of bed and I went to the end of the bed. There was a dresser with a big mirror over it, and I stood like this and I looked in that mirror. This is the part I like least, but I got to tell it. I've got to tell you what I saw because I can't forget it. I've got to keep reminding myself of the reflection I saw in that mirror. I saw the reflection of an old, beaten woman. My face was all swollen and my eyes were almost closed. And I was dirty. I hadn't bathed. My kid used to tell me, Mommy, you smell bad. And I hadn't combed my hair or anything. I hadn't changed my clothes. I had the little house coat on. And I had everything spilled down the front of it because I found out I drank up everything in the house, including the dry vermouth and the vanilla, the sweet vermouth too. And I tried to eat something along the way, and that was spilled down the front of me. And I saw this reflection of this person. Is that me? It was like the revelation, the moment of truth, like really seeing for the first time what I'd become. And I saw this reflection of this horrible creature in the mirror, and I thought, that's me, you know? I saw the reflection of the room in the back and the dirty unmade bed and the bottles thrown under the bed and the burns on this bedside table, and there were black marks going up the wall that we never could figure out how they got there. And I knew that probably, you know, I ought to clean up a little bit before Jeannie came, and I started pacing the floor. I didn't want to miss her. I remember sending my daughter across the street to play. And I started pacing the floor. I can't remember any time in my entire life that I needed a drink any more than I needed a drink that morning. I started to perspire, and I started to shake, and my heart started to pound, and I thought, I have got to have a drink. That's when I found out I drank everything up, because I opened all the cupboards and looked in the refrigerator and all over the place, under things, in things, couldn't find anything to drink, and everything I found was empty. And then here's something I didn't tell for a long time either. I went back in the bedroom and I crawled on my hands and knees under the bed, looking at all of the empties under there, hoping to find one with that much in it. You know the feeling? Just a little bit. Just enough to get me through. Empties. Then I remembered my husband had a refrigerator out in the garage where he sometimes kept beer, and I went running out, you know, to that detached garage I told you about, and I opened that refrigerator and it was empty. And I thought, well, this is it. I'm going to have to go and get me something to drink. And then all of a sudden I spotted a beer bottle under the workbench, and I thought, well, it's probably an empty. But I went crawling in that dust down underneath the workbench, and I got a hold of that bottle and pulled it out. It had a cap on it. And I put it down on the kitchen table, and I uncapped that warm beer, and I started to drink it in slow sips. Oh, the feeling I get when I say that, because that is a very significant point in my life. That is the last drink of anything with alcohol in it that I've had to have up to this very moment. Now, that always amazes me when I say it. How come? What happened to me? Here's a gal that drank for 20 years. The last 10 years, I didn't go a day without a drink. The last 5 years, I was in and out of hospitals almost all the time, bumping into things, falling, passing out, going through all those antics I told you about. And all of a sudden, I'm standing here tonight telling you that I haven't had a drink for 10.5 years. How come? What happened to me? What was the ingredient, the magic, the thing that entered into my life at that point? Let me describe it to you by telling you something that I was thinking about this afternoon. Nancy and I got up this morning and we went out into the sunshine, and I've never been here in the spring before. I've always been here in the fall, and I've been here, it's always reminded me of Thanksgiving, the coming of Christmas, a roaring fire, cold, crispy air, you know? And I've always looked forward to that experience in the fall. This is the first time I've ever been here in the spring. It is definitely a place for me of renewal, rejuvenation. It's a place where I once again regain a completeness within me. It's a very special place. And that's why I felt so choked up when I got up here tonight and stood and looked at all of you people. From the very first time I came here, it's just been so special to me. There's no place else like the mountain. And there are no other people like you people. And we talk about coming back to the mountain. I can remember one time when my son was looking at colleges, and we drove him up to Suwannee to look at it, and I said to the family, I want to take you over to show you the conference center where I go in the fall. I want you to see what it looks like. And we drove over here and drove in around the circle and drove back out, and it wasn't the same. It was just an empty building. There was nobody here. And I thought back on that this afternoon. It isn't the building, the place, or even the trees and the beauty and the newness and the spring and the rebirth. It's the people. It's you. Because when you come, I sat and watched you this afternoon, and I saw the people arriving. And as people arrived, you'd jump up and you'd go and greet them and you'd put your arms around them. I've never seen so much warmth and love in my whole life, anywhere. That's what I felt the first time I came here. That's what I feel every time I come. And you know, that's what's made me well. That's the healing power. It's in you. When I came to this program, I didn't believe in God. I thought I was an atheist. I said, who needs a crutch like God? And I realized after I'd read the big book that the category of the wanderer was where I was. I had wandered so far away from any belief in a higher power that I had to turn around and I had to start the long journey back. I had a faith of my childhood. My faith today is so different. The God of my childhood was a fearful God, the one that wouldn't let you do anything fun, you know, anything interesting. The God I have today is so different. But that's been the hardest part of my recovery. As sick as I was physically, mentally, the spiritual illness was the most devastating for me. I don't think you can get any spiritually sicker than to want to take your own life. And that's the point where I was that night. I listen to you people here at Mont Eagle and to people in AA everywhere because I've gone to a lot of meetings. And everybody that I admired who seemed to have the glow, seemed to have the program, seemed to be living the way of life I wanted to live, talked about spiritual things. So I knew that was the answer. I've come to believe that life is a spiritual journey, and certainly my recovery from alcoholism is a spiritual journey. And it's only in so much as I remember to turn my will and my life over to God on a daily basis that I can continue my spiritual journey. I have a tendency, you see, because of my humanness, to want to take it back in my own hands and run the show, do it my way. I have a tendency to say, hey, God, this isn't the way I want it. This isn't the way I planned it. You're off course, God. You know, and then I remember, it's not my plan, it's His. God has a plan for my life. All of you people in this room are part of that plan. I've come to believe that He sends people my way, He sends circumstances my way, and the things that happen to me are all part of that plan. And it's a big, bold, beautiful plan if I'll just let it happen, if I'll give in to it and let it happen. In the beginning, I couldn't even say the word God. It stuck in my throat. In the beginning, when I came to this program, I put another O in it and used good for a long time, you know? I can remember walking into a meeting one night, and I went every night in the beginning, and a man I'd gotten to know stuck out his hand, and he said, congratulations, Bunny, you have 10 days today. Now, here's this human being who went those 20 years drinking and went through all those horrible things I've just told you about, and I haven't had a drink for 10 days. You know, I stood there and this feeling went through me right from my head to my toes, and I thought, me? Me? I haven't had a drink for 10 days? And all of a sudden, it was such a big moment for me because I realized with the spiritual awakening innate in all of the principles of this program, I realized that the power I saw working in you people was working in my life. Even in me, it was working. I wasn't drinking. And I was just doing some simple things that you people told me. Oh, I pray sometimes, please, God, let me keep this program simple. Don't let me complicate it. You know, I was doing some very simple things. I couldn't even understand the steps at that point. I was just asking for help in the morning, not taking a drink during the day, going to meetings, and saying thank you at night. That's what they told me to do. They said, if you don't know anything else, do that. And that's what I still do on a daily basis to achieve the sobriety that I know and love today. And in the beginning, I was saying, God, if you're there, I don't know if you're there, but if you're there, please take this, you know, day and let me get through it without having to take a drink, you know. And then going to bed at night, and sometimes all I'd say is, thank you, God, and I'd be asleep. Then all of a sudden, I realized I wasn't doing that anymore. What I was saying was, instead of God, if you're there, I was saying, God, thank you for being there. When I had been in this program 2 months, and I was on a pink cloud, you wouldn't believe. Oh, it was just so nice to be able to see the stars, the moon, the streets on the, at night with the lights, you know, and the people and everything. And my husband came home and said, we're moving again. Can you believe it? Again. And here I was with my new life and a wonderful sponsor and a program, and I was sober for the first time in years. And he comes home and tells me we're going to move. And I thought, well, I can't go with him. I can't go. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and my sponsor in Houston said, I'll never forget what she said. She said, you have to go with your family, Bunny. And she said, AA is everywhere. They're the same people, they just have different faces. I'll never forget that, because everywhere I've gone and I've been to meetings from New York to California, I've met those people, the same people, with different faces. You know, and she was right, and I moved with my family, and I came to Nashville, and I remember that they didn't do things the same in Nashville, and I got some resentments. Some things happened concerning our move, and I got some more resentments, and I began to get mad at the world and mad at life, and I wasn't taking care of it, you know? I left an AA meeting one Monday night, and I was going to AA. And this is what I thought. Get this. It's really interesting. When I went to the car, I was angry and had all this resentment inside. And I said to myself, I'll show them all. I'll get drunk. Get that. I'll show them all. I'll get drunk. Who was I going to show what? How ridiculous can you be, you know? And I remember driving home that night. I never had a drink in Nashville or in Tennessee, for that matter. I used to drive home and never look in the liquor stores. And this night I looked in every one as I went by, and I thought, where should I stop? And I finally stopped at an SDI store in Donaldson where I lived, and I went in the SDI store. I decided I would start on beer. And I marched in that SDI store, big as life, and I opened the beer case, and I reached in, brave as anything, you know? And I had my hand around the neck of a quart bottle of Miller's High Life. All of a sudden, this feeling went through me, and I thought, what am I doing? I'm about to buy a bottle. And I know if I buy a bottle of beer, I'm going to get drunk. I know that. What am I throwing away? What's happening to me? And there in that SDI store, I did something I had never really done before. To myself, I said, God, help me. I've taken my will back in my own life, and look what's happening. I'm about to buy a bottle, and I'm about to get drunk. If you're there, you've got to take this thing, which is my drinking problem, from me. I simply can't handle it. I closed the case, and I opened the one next to it. And I bought a bottle, big bottle of Tab, and I paid for it, and I went home. We were still in the stage of my recovery where if I came home and came home sober, it was something to be grateful for. And I walked in with this bag under my arm, and I put it on the counter, and I took the Tab out and put it down, and my husband looked at it and went, phew. No. We'd gotten through another day. But you know, he'll never know what really happened to me that night in that SDI store. I turned my will and life over to God and let go for the first time. I can remember even feeling different physically. I felt like there was all this weight on my shoulders, and I had gotten rid of it, and I could stand up straight, hold my shoulders back, put my chin up, look people in the eye again. I felt different physically when I did that. And do you know something? I haven't wanted a drink of alcohol since that night. I have not wanted a drink of alcohol. But let me tell you something else about that. I didn't trust just doing that once in that SDI store. Step three is pretty important to me because I take it every single morning of my life. Every morning I'm reborn into a new lifetime existing of 24 hours. And I figure I've got to take care of that 24 hours. So I turn my will and my life over to God, and it always goes something like, God, here I am again. You know, that alcoholic who can't manage her own life. Take my will and my life today. And just let me know what your will is for me this 24 hours. What a beautiful way to live. I don't know why I didn't think of it years ago. All I have to do is cope with now, this 24 hours. I don't have to live all of yesterday and all of tomorrow. What a beautiful way to live. And I have to keep reminding myself about that. So that was the beginning of a relationship with a power that worked even for this stubborn old gal who didn't believe it would. It worked anyway, you know? And the best way I can describe to you where I am right now, today, on the spiritual journey, is to tell you another story of my childhood. We used to like to take long walks together when we were kids. There were four girls, and this was when there were just three of us. And I always liked it best when Mom and Dad went along. And one of our favorite places to go was a place called Durney's Fields. I came across a poem as I was looking through my things that I wrote one time in Durney's Field, and my sister painted a picture. And it used to be one of our favorite places. We used to go there for picnics and pick daisies, and we used to climb a big hill there, and since it was in Pleasantville, New York, about 30 miles up from New York City, when you got up on Flag Hill, you could see the Empire State Building. It was then the tallest building in New York, and you could see across the Hudson River. And we loved to go up there on a clear day. Any time of year, it was beautiful. But in order to get there, you had to go through this dark, swampy place. And there was a pond there, and it was black. And they called it Black Pond. But one of the things I've admitted about when I was a kid was that of the things I was afraid of, I was scared to death of the cellar stairs, the boogeyman, and Black Pond, in that order. You know, and I was just afraid of Black Pond because they said it didn't have any bottom, and that's why it was called Black Pond. And I used to walk around that pond like this, and I'd think, if I ever fell in there, it doesn't have any bottom, I'd never come up. Scared me to death. But you know, if my father was there, and he was one of my dearest friends, and we were walking around Black Pond, and I'd look up at him, and he was big and strong, and I'd reach over, I'd take his hand. And I'd look at him, and I'd hold his hand real tight, and I'd say, "Who's afraid of Black Pond? Not me. Because my dad is here. He's with me, and he's going to take care of me. I know that he's not going to let anything happen to me. I know that." Well, I don't have a loving earthly father anymore. But you know what? I've got a loving Heavenly Father today. And one of the things I just know about my life is the fact that He's going to take care of me today. If I remember to reach over and tap into that source of strength, that the God of my understanding isn't going to leave me alone to fend for myself today. He and I can do it together. And you know, of all the things that have come my way since I've been sober, and believe me, there have been a lot more things in my sobriety that I've had to contend with than I ever did drinking. And he's always seen me through. I've never had a day when he wasn't there, but I remembered every morning to ask him for help. Please be with me today. One of the most beautiful things about my life today are the people in my life. Many of you have meant much more to me than you will ever, ever know. Many of you, when I started to come to Mount Eagle, frightened, lonely, could hardly even talk to people, came up to me and hugged me, sat down and talked to me, showed me you cared, and I'll never, never forget that. You know, it meant so much to me, and no matter where I go today, when I'm with AA people, I've found the place I fit. It's home. It's the place where I'm comfortable. It's the place where I belong. You know, for the first time in my life, I want to borrow a few words from John Powell. You know, John Powell says, talks about roots, a sense of a belonging in a place called home. And that's what I've found with you people. I have found home. And as the 24-hour book says, I no longer wander alone over the face of the earth. I'm never alone anymore because I have you people and I have that power that I have found through you people. And another thing that I borrow from John Powell that this program has given me is wings. Roots and wings. Freedom. You see, I'm free today. I'm free to do and be and grow and experience and love and work and pray and all of those things I've always wanted to do that I never could really do because I didn't know how. Among the things that I found was a poem I wrote to my oldest son when he was a baby. He's 26 now. That's a long time ago. I had poetry within me then that hadn't really had a chance to grow and be expressed. But I wrote this little poem, and in it I talked about three things I wanted to give him. And the three things I wanted to give him were freedom, love, and truth. So you see, I knew what the important things in life were, even then. I knew what the values were. I simply didn't have a program to steer me. I knew where I wanted to go, but I didn't know how to get there. And I had to go through all of that, what I call my valley of the shadow, to come out where I am today, where I can begin to live according to the things that I really believe. This program has brought me many, many blessings. And before I end, I just want to tell you about just a couple. And they involve my children. I don't think there's anything we talk about that has any more meaning or that disturbs us anymore than how it used to be with our kids and the way it is now. I missed an awful lot of their growing up, and I missed an awful lot of their development. I have two boys and a girl. And the little girl was a real pleasure because I always wanted to have a little girl. And in the beginning, my drinking wasn't so bad that I couldn't make the bedtimes and the little stories and the programs at school. And then as my drinking got so bad, I missed a whole part of her life. I was never there. I was passed out. I was sent away from the table many times because I couldn't find my mouth with my fork and put to bed. And I missed a lot of the years of her growing up. And I wondered desperately when I sobered up, how can I make up for all the things that I've missed, you know? How can I be the kind of mother I always wanted to be? And you people have showed me that I must just start to be the kind of mother that I should have been all along. And today, my daughter and I are good friends. We don't always agree. We're quite different, but we're friends. One of my biggest treasures is a card she gave me one Mother's Day. I had been sober for some time, and on the card she said, "You're not just my mother, but you're my sister and my best friend." And you know, you can't plan things like that. That's the kind of reward that comes to us as a result of this program that you can't plan. You know, that's the kind of thing God has in store for you, that you couldn't plan for yourself if you tried. And then I remembered, looking back on the sober years we've had together, and she's not living at home now, but I remembered times when we were sisters. I remembered her coming home from dates and kneeling down by the bed and talking to me. I remember her crying in my arms. I remember us laughing on horseback together, walking in the rain and giggling like schoolgirls. I remembered all of that. I remember her sharing and opening up and caring about how I felt. I remembered that going on, and just recently we went together to see the florist because we're planning her wedding. She's going to get married in August. And, you know, I had to pass some of those blessings on to you. I have two sons who are already married, and one of the biggest moments of my life was the day that I got to sit in the front pew next to my husband and my oldest son got married. He's the one I had hurt so deeply. And I remember so well the feeling I had because, you see, nobody but you would understand. I almost missed it. I almost wasn't there. And I sat there just beaming from ear to ear as I watched my son standing up there at the altar, first on one foot and on the other in this white suit, you know. And then all of a sudden his face changed. And that moment I hold in my heart because his whole countenance changed. And I turned and his bride was coming up the aisle in the arm of her father, the woman he loved. And I got to be there and share it. And so I want to share it with you. And then the other big moment I have to tell you about my middle son, who never said much, and I never knew how deeply hurt he was because, you know, he didn't talk about it. And two summers ago, he came home one time from working at Opryland, and he said, "Mom, sit down, I want to talk to you." And he shared something with me that warmed my heart. He'd been dating this little girl all summer, and he said, "Mama, Janet and I are in love, and we want to get married." And he said, "I want you to be the first to know that." And he said, I need your help." And he had all planned. What he was going to do was come home on a Thursday night from Opryland, where she worked too, and bring her home with him, and he was going to ask her. And if she said yes, he wasn't sure she would. Then he was going to take her by the next night, her parents, and ask them if it was all right. And then take her by and pick out a ring, and he wanted me to go with him and select some rings for her to choose from. You know, so this was the big plan, and I'll never forget that Thursday night. My husband was out of town, and my daughter was in bed with me, and we heard them come home after Opryland, and it was late, about 11. And we heard them come in the house, and we're laying in bed just like schoolgirls. We're so excited we can't lay still, you know. And we didn't hear anything for a long time. And then all of a sudden, the bedroom door opened and the light went on. And here are these two beautiful young people standing at the foot of the bed. And my son's face was beaming and he said, "Mom, she said yes." I'll never forget the moment. And I was there and I got to share it and experience it with him. And we celebrated there and jumped up and down on the bed and called my husband long distance, and they called the radio station and had their song played at midnight, and it was a grand celebration. I got to be there for those things. Oh, the blessings are so tremendous, I can't tell all of them to you. I can't include them all, but they're there, and they happen to me on a daily basis. The blessings, the wonder of sobriety. If I can just remember to be grateful, if I can just remember to be thankful. And one of the things that I never want to forget, because it's the most important thing of all, I never want to forget to reach over and take his hand, because I know that that's where the strength is. Thank you, God, for being there.